And then what did you do after New York?
Well, after New York, I was participating in a festival in Spain, in Madrid, and I was conducting the Alea ensemble, and I met again there a Canadian composer whom I have very briefly met in Washington, D.C., maybe a year before, Bruce Mader. And he attended my concert, which was a little bit out of the ordinary, with color lights and strobe lights, and I was conducting just musicians and mostly Latin American repertoire. I think there was a John Cage piece as well. So Bruce Mader invited me for Sangria the following day. And over Sangria, he told me that there was a position at McGill. He told me, I work at McGill University, and we are looking for someone with international reputation, a composer that can teach advanced composition, but he has to be a specialist on electronic music. And he thought that I could qualify, that I should apply. So I applied and I got the job. That's why I came. That was 1970, and I came to McGill in September 71.
And when you got to McGill, what did you find there?
We were still in the old building on Mountain Street and Dr. Penfield.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. I don't know the history to that.
Well, the building is still there. It's called now the Martlet House. You get the picture, Mountain Street.
Yes.
And Dr. Penfield.
Yes.
Is the east, northeast corner. It's like a beautiful mansion, still there.
Right.
That was the Faculty of Music. And it was very small, even if the number of students and professors was also small. So a few classes went on there. The library, the music library, was there, and all the professors, we have our offices there, and the dean and blah blah blah. But the faculty or McGill, they used to rent a few other houses in the area for the students to have practice rooms for rehearsals. And there was another old mansion on La Rue du Musée, the one that goes direct, and Dr. Penfield, which used to be called MacGregor. I don't remember what the name of that street was. I think it was called MacGregor.
MacGregor's still there.
No, then I'm confusing. Because Dr. Penfield, that name was given not too long ago.
Oh, okay.
When I came, the name was different. But in any case, that house is no longer there. But that was the piano department.
Okay.
All the Dorothy Morton, all the big piano teachers, so all the piano students for classes and maybe for practice went there. That house, in the back, had an old garage. It was actually that old. It was a coach house for carriages with horses. That was the electronic studio, which was, Kevin has to remember this very well, because the first 2 or 3 months we were there, and Kevin taught me, he was my student, but he taught me how to use the Moog synthesizer.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't know, and I had to teach it later on. So,
but the studio already had a Moog.
Yes. They have the Lecaine machinery and the Moog synthesizer. That was it. Nothing else.
Right.
And not all of the Lecaine machinery was being used or displayed because of lack of space. If I remember well, was maybe from here a room, like from here to that wall. And then another little room. And that was it.
Right. It's very small.
Yeah. So the first term, September through December, I didn't teach that class. I taught other classes, and Kevin was my student, composition student in the other classes. But at the same time, he was instructed by Paul Peterson to teach me how to use the things I didn't know, which was part of the Le Cain machinery and the Moog synthesizer. Because let's go back to New York. At the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Studios, they never had a complete Moog synthesizer. We, in the Studio 106, we only have the VCAs and the corresponding envelope generators, and no keyboard. So you could prepare some sort of mixture and process through the VCA and the envelope generator, but you had to trigger with two push buttons, and the type that our grandparents used to have for the lights near their bed at night. It's called a perilla in Spanish. A push button.
A squeeze button.
Those were the triggers. Okay. Yeah. So if you wanted to do do, re, mi, fa, sol, you had to do it five times and change the pitch on the mixture and trigger again.
Once at a time.
So well, you could do two at a time.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and the first complete synthesizer that arrived was not the Moog at Columbia Princeton. At the end of 65, the Buchla boxes arrived with Mr. Buchla explaining. And that was our introduction to voltage control.
Wow. Okay.
Up to that point, there had been no voltage control. Le Cain did have it, but the rest of the world didn't know.
Right.
So, back to... Yeah, now back to Montreal. I say, in New York and the rest of the world, they didn't know about voltage control until Buchla or Moog started, which is around that time, 1964-65. So that was in the garage or coach house where the electronic studio was. And at Christmas time, 71, we moved to the Strathcona Music Building. And from January 72, I started teaching electronic music. So when we moved to the electronic studio there, we, of the four rooms, only two were with machinery, because one was the Moog studio, as we call it, with a Moog and a few tape recorders, and the main studio was only Le Cain machinery at the beginning. And
so was part of the Le Cain machinery, there must have been a tape recorder in there. There was the poly?
No, the poly, yeah, the poly was there, yeah, in 71.
With other tape recorders, or it was just Le Cain machinery?
No, no, Le Cain machinery for sound production and processing, but there were tape recorders, Ampexes.
Right.
One modified by Le Cain, which was the model 350 or something like that, that could play 15... 7.5, 3 3/4, and 1 7/8, all switchable.
He
modified that himself. Yeah. And I think it was full track. I'm not certain of that. Kevin will remember. Yeah. No, regular tape, but full track. Yeah. But there were a few, or we began buying them. The idea was to have at least two or four half-track tape recorders, most of them with switchable heads for four tracks on half an inch tape on each room. So those were the 440 Ampexes, and then a few Scully tape recorders.
And so when you were teaching at McGill, you must have had some time to compose still.
So yes.
What was the first couple of pieces than you did at McGill?
'71, Plectros 3, and of course I was in love with the Le Cain instruments. So that for me was a big novelty.
Right.
So Plectros 3, Penetration 7, which is the middle part of my trilogy now, and one of the pieces I wrote for Meg. Let me see what else. I don't remember. Let me have a catalog here too. So yeah, Plectrus 3, Aedesis 3, which is for one or two orchestras and tape, again with Lekain instruments. Ekphonesis 4 is tape and slides with Guernica. I took it apart. It was supposed to be a film. That project started in New York, so half was done in New York of the music, but I finished it here. But we couldn't get the grant with Jérôme Ducrot, a French filmmaker, with whom I have done the music for another of his films earlier. And then I moved to Montreal, so it was abandoned, but I decided to do it with slide projectors. I don't know how legal it is. Meg doesn't want me to. I still have all the slides. So I took the Guernica apart so you only see the themes, the main ideas, the hand and the horse head and whatever. And that's what the audience see why the music goes on. And then at the golden mean point, the complete Guernica shows up, but very small in the center. And it gets bigger and bigger. It's like the audience is... And it ends with Guernica at night, all in flames, with pictures taken from newspapers and things like that. So that was finished here. Acouphenos 2, which is for chamber ensemble on electronic sounds. Yeah, I think I stopped there because then too much time has passed and I probably still use some Lekain instruments. But
at the time when you went to the McGill Studios, were they calling it electronic music? Like, what were you calling what you were doing?
Yeah, we still call it... we did consider changing the nomenclature, but it's still called McGill Electronic Music Studio. The decision was that it was too late to change. Now, if we talk about what do we teach, what do we do at the McGill EMS, we might use terminology like tape music, digital music, electroacoustics, which we all kind of agree is a more versatile type of terminology. But the name of the studio has remained electronic music.
EMS. Who were the first people that you met then when you came to McGill? You mentioned Kevin Austin and Sheila Kane and Bruce Mather, but who are some of the other people who went to the studio?
Well, the director of the studio was Paul Peterson.
Okay, so Paul Peterson was the director.
So the initial director and founder was István Anhalt. And then when Anhalt decided to move to Kingston, he went to work at Queens. He still lives in Kingston. Paul Peterson became the director, and I became Professor Angel's replacement. I came to replace. Well, that was the position open. And eventually, a couple of years later, Paul Peterson became associate dean, and he was to be the future dean. A year or two later, so he couldn't run the studio anymore, so we came up with Hambreus and me as co-directors, 1974. But a year later, Hambreus, he thought that he has done enough of paperwork at the Swedish Broadcasting Corporation, and he didn't want to have anything to do with the running of the studio, so I became de facto the electronic music studio director. And that was until 2003, when Sean Ferguson became co-director with me. And a year later, he's the director of the electronic studio. I am being promoted to director emeritus of the EMS.
Bravo, congratulations. Congratulations. Well,
thank you.
So, who were the students then at McGill at the time that you were working with? Were people who were...
Well, Kevin Austin was my student, not necessarily in the electronic studio, but he was in my composition seminar. I remember very well having to go to a small tenement on McTavish Street, or maybe it was Drummond, between Sherbrooke and Dr. Penfield, where we used to rent a space. So if you needed a rehearsal room, you went there. So it was a piece for, I think it was Brass Quintet and Tape by Kevin Austin. I think he was playing tuba.
Right.
Okay. Rick Lawton, that eventually became the dean, and he's still around, he was a trombone player. I don't remember the other performance, but I was a conductor. So I conducted. And I think, I don't know if Kevin, he must have a recording, but I had to check with him because we found one tape with nothing written on it, and I insist that has to be Kevin Quintet. But one of these days I had to check with him, but I conducted. So that's what we used to do. We had to walk 3 blocks to go and have a rehearsal.
Did everyone end up carrying their instruments the 3 blocks?
Yeah, you have to. And sometimes you have to walk even longer. They used to have, because the faculty was too small on that building, and the students were growing in number. So they rented any number of spaces in dilapidated buildings just so you could go and practice or have your rehearsal.
Right.
So when finally they got the Strathcona and it was repainted and modified, it was the first time that all was brought together in one space.
Was it possible to study only electroacoustic music or electronic music at the time? No,
it was never possible at McGill. The curriculum has remained more or less the same. Students in composition, or they could be in more recent years in sound recording, other programs. They have what was called a 300 level 1 year of electroacoustic music composition that was mandatory. At least for the composition students, you couldn't graduate with your bachelor's degree unless you did 1 year there, or in the master's. You never did electroacoustic music, it's mandatory. You had to do 1 year. And then there was a graduate seminar that was the beginning of computer music without computers. It's a different story. Peterson used to teach that. I used to teach the undergraduates in composition. And then there was so much interest that I proposed to do the 200 level for non-composers in order to be able to separate the composers who might be very familiar with certain terminology and names, Berio, Stockhausen, you throw the name, they understand. But if there was a poet, a dancer, or someone from another faculty trying to take electronic music, and they say, what? What's that? How you spell that? Yuzachevsky, never heard of it. So we decided, and that was a very successful class. Many people from Concordia, after 1 year with Kevin or you or someone else, they will come and try to take that class. It was the 200 level class. It doesn't exist anymore. And at present, I think is either 2 years or 1.5 between music tech as preparation or introduction to electronics, etc., and 1 year in the composition with electroacoustic means class. Then there is the graduate seminar, which different name but still exists. So anyone, they had the chance to do 2.5 years if they are doing at least the undergraduate and one of the graduate programs. 2.5 years contact with the laboratories.
Mm-hmm. But it seems there were a number of people who went through who really focused on electronic composition.
Yeah, but maybe you're thinking the way they had it at Université de Montréal, that you can get your master's on electroacoustics is not possible at McGill. No, you can get your master's in composition,
right,
or in sound recording, or in trombone, and you might take as an elective or mandatory electronic music, but you cannot graduate on electronic music. It's not in the program. It doesn't exist. I don't agree with that, but that's the way it is. Okay.
Who else then came along in terms of faculty later on then at McGill? When did Bruce Pennycook
start? No, that's much later.
Much later.
Yeah, yeah. I get to it. At the beginning, it was, well, Hambreus and me, because Petersen, when he became dean, and he was dean like 10 years, he was teaching less and less. He never taught composition, and he used to do, let's get back to the computer music. So the graduate seminar every second year was called computer music. But there were no computers in 1972, 73, 75 at the Faculty of Music. We didn't have them. So he used to go to the mainframe computer of the administration at midnight with the class to teach the students.
He got his students to show up at midnight?
Yes. And to have their studio lab time after midnight, very frequent. With the McGill EMS was always open 6 days per week, 24 hours.
Wow.
So it was common to have people overnight working for different reasons. It's quiet, you can have more hours. Some people that maybe they live in Ottawa,
right,
and they only came for a day and a half and still trying to take the full load. Different reasons. And the other thing that Petersen did, besides using the administration mainframe computer, was to take the students to Ottawa. And one of the things I was cooking there was Hugh LeCain already working with computers. So that he didn't do it every week, but maybe every 2 months, they will rent a bus and go to Ottawa, have the computer music class there. Well, that went, from the early 70s, I will say, easily until 1980, because the first computer synthesizer that entered the Faculty of Music for administration or for music was the one at the EMS, and it was a Synclavier, and that was 1981.
Right.
And it was the first time in my life that I saw a computer, that I had to learn how to use a computer. You know, it might sound strange to you young people, but for an older guy like me, I never had to touch a computer until I was 51 years old. It was the same year when I had to learn how to ice skate, so I would take my children to the Van Horn Park.
Ice skating and computers.
First contact with ice skating, of course, in Argentina, you don't do that. And we had to use a computer in order to be 2 weeks ahead of the students so I could pretend that I was teaching. I was 50 or 51 years old. It was a Synclavier with the Able 60 computer. It was a computer designed for the industry or for, accounting, being adapted and adopted by New England Digital as the CPU within the Synclavier that we got. It was already Synclavier 2, but the first unit we got. 2 or 3 years later, we put more money, and they changed, and it was already the beginning of the Macintoshes. I don't remember that too well. But I remember the Able 60, and the memory was like this, and the speed was... I remember one of the things I did, my first choir piece, Sensors 4, I wanted to sample Meg's voice, and I did, from my trilogy, when she had to say "Memories," and in the score of that, written in Berlin in 1972, it says that the singer has to take 14 seconds to do that,
right,
low register. So I went to the recording from Germany, I took that, And now the Sinclavier let me do that. The Able 60, I could put it on the screen and see all the memories. And it was my introduction to the Fourier transform. And the computer synthesizer, the Sinclavier, had the potential to give us, what do you call that? I cannot come up with a name. Well, a two-dimensional display of all the presence of harmonics. What do you call that?
Spectrogram?
Okay. So the Sinclavier could do two-dimensionally or in three dimensions. But after I discovered that to do it in two dimensions, it took about 3 minutes. In three dimensions, you better come back next day. I gave up with a three. And I was satisfied. But that census 4 is all taken out of that moment. So that multiplied by whatever became 15 minutes is the shape of the piece.
Right.
And I sliced it with a computer. And again, I was learning how to... maybe the question was, memories, okay? The M going to the E, me. Is it the same as the M coming from the E going to the O? And the answer is no, they are completely different. When we type, when we write, we use the same symbol. But that's not what the spectrogram will tell you. It's very, very different. So I did all the tape part by taking different slices and discovering that when you open, this is a filter. And that vowel, E, well, there are many colors along the way in these few milliseconds. So I took all that. It was like cutting pieces of salami, learning a lot. And then discovering that the sampler on the Sinclavier was monophonic at 50K, terrific speed, but monophonic, the one we had at that time. And the tape I was producing was supposed to be somewhat polyphonic, and I had to use shortcuts, so in a way, portions of the tape, which sounds like vocal chords with Meg's voice after the sampling and blah, 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 were done as polyphonic sequencers on the Sinclavier with sine tones. And then I substituted, after I got what I wanted, layer by layer, they were already synchronized. I exchanged. There was a special little subroutine, we used to call those things in that time. Another little program in the Sinclavier that will let you remove this sine tone or whatever it was and put something else instead on a already existing musical sequence. And that's the way I do it. It sounds polyphonic, but it was strictly monophonic sampling. That was the first computer.
How long was it, did it take to actually do one small task?
It depends what it was. Certain things like the three-dimensionality took a long, long time. Many other things were almost immediate.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. If you were, the system was designed to work on sine tones, what you call that, additive synthesis and subtractive synthesis. So the system was very quick on all that. It's immediate. You never notice the difference. But sampling was a different story. But a good sampling rate, 50K was excellent. The quality was phenomenal, but it was strictly monophonic.
What was the next instrument that came along? The next tool?
Well, we skipped one section earlier than the Sinclavier. We went through the ARP 2600.
Oh, you had one of those?
Yes,
two?
We did have one of those two. And
are you still using the...
The Lecaim was always used learning how to deal with things that were too noisy or not working properly, until we passed them to the museum in Ottawa, probably around 1985, 86, I don't remember exactly. Not all the, like, for example, the multi-track tape recorder was already almost not operational at the time when I came in. We have a beautiful photo, Kevin and me, with the, or maybe it's only Kevin at the multitrack. But we were using the Spring Reverb stereo that was inside the multitrack because it was the, we didn't have a Lexicon at that time. So it was the best Spring Reverb echo chamber I ever seen. And it was truly stereo. It was like having two different units. But the multi-track capabilities for what it was designed to play multiple tapes, we were no longer using it. It was beyond repair. I don't remember. There was something with the electronics that Eric Johnstone was a technician. We couldn't get the parts anymore. I should have called the guy in Buenos Aires. He was too young at the time. Okay.
So back to the art.
Well, let me finish with the Lecaine. The Lecaine's, the tone mixture generators, some of the voltage control filters that he did, even if they were not called voltage control, but that's, it was an outside control that you could utilize, that was being used all the time, and so it was the timers. Actually, I wrote a paper on how to use the timers. I don't know if you are interested in that. which were 13-step sequencers. But in 1971, 72, there were no sequencers in the market. So when you have nothing, having, and we used to have three or four of those, so let's say 3 times 13, you could have a sequence with 39 steps if you wanted, if you use everything to control pitch. Now, normally we have one timer taking care of the 13 different notes, pitch. But another timer perhaps was synchronizing the envelope generators or the attack generator or filters all together at the same time simultaneously. And then you only got 13 notes. But we never bought the sequences for the Moog synthesizer. We always used the Lecaine all the way until we parted with them. They were that effective. And Lecaine developed that 10 years before any sequencers were in the market. No kidding, it's true.
That always what boggles my mind with the Lecaine inventions, that people were looking for them. They wanted them.
But you're a Canadian. You're a born Canadian. But I was one that was looking at the world or at Canada from outside Canada. Okay, from Argentina, we knew about, what was the name? Norman McLaren.
Right.
That we knew. Mm-hmm. End of story. Canada didn't exist. Maybe the Mounted Police. Right. Some movies with Nelson Eddy with disguised as the Mounted Police. I don't know. We knew nothing.
Right.
Norman McLaren, not everyone, but I used to go to Cinematheques. Being in Buenos Aires is different from being in Toronto or New York. Okay, Montreal is a little bit like Buenos Aires. Many Cinematheques, much coming from Europe. But Canada, nothing. But going to Cinematheques, all these initial movies with the soundtrack, Norman McLaren, of course we knew about that. But at the time, if you ask me about a Canadian writer, Canadian composer, Canadian poet, no? Ice hockey means nothing to Argentinians.
Right.
So, blank. So why will anyone be interested about Hugh Lecaine's inventions? And he didn't know how to commercialize them.
Right.
There were attempts, but nothing was truly successful. The Poli, that is truly the first voltage-controllable polyphonic synthesizer in the world. He developed that. I mean, I came to McGill in 1971. It was already there. And I saw with Kevin, we had to do whatever because it was not working. And Paul Piden said, it has to go back to Ottawa and Lecaim will fix it. And then 6 months later, already in the Strathcona Music Building, there it was back, fully repaired, with Lecaim giving us a lecture on how to use it because there was no manual. So we were all there, the technician before Eric Johnston, me and Paul Peterson taking notes. And the Kane will go and he say, sign tone. Again the same. And that was the explanation. It was full of and the sound was changing, and I was like, he was not a very talkative man. He just did it. Yeah, that was beginning of 72. Prior to that, Lecaim had been visiting professor at the Faculty of Music.
Right.
I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what he did. Probably visiting professor Lecaim. Maybe he came, once every second month for a lecture or two. He was not there every week. Grace, are you going to try that?
I don't think so.
She's okay now.
You're cute. But when you go out there and you saw the Poli, did you have any sense that it was like the first of its kind in the world? Was there, did anybody have to say?
Well,
no one else is building these things, right?
We knew because it really started as a request from Paul Peterson. That's why the joke still goes around. Even Paul Peterson laughed at it. We don't know if we call it Poli, short for polyphonic, or Poli because it was Paul Peterson's idea. So Lecaim, I don't know which one he did it more or less as a request from István Anhalt of the different units, but at some point before my time here, he came to McGill when he was visiting professor and he said, well, I have done all this. Great. Give me ideas. I do something for you. So Paul Peterson told him, well, look, in the other room we have the Moog synthesizer. It's marvelous machinery. It has all this, but it's monophonic. That's a big limitation. Can you work on that? Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of the polyphony. And he had the full unit by 1970, in the coach house where Kevin was, I wasn't. And that's 8 or 9 years before the Moog became polyphonic.
Wow.